Welcome to the Inclusive Collective. I am your co-host, Nadia Butt, and I am joined with my other co-host, Rob Hadley. Hey, Rob, how are you this week?
Nadia, I'm doing great. So good to be here.
Good to see you, or be with you, I should say, since, you know, this is the podcast and I can't see you. I had a question for you, though.
Oh, lovely. What do we got?
Does your family do Taco Tuesday?
No.
Love tacos, so I'm just curious if you do tacos on Tuesday.
I was just at an amazing taco place on the way back from, we were floating the Colorado River, and I stopped in Green River, Utah, right across the Colorado-Utah border. Fantastic place. Don't remember the name, so maybe I'll have to put that in the show notes. It was very difficult to remember, but just fantastic trucks. Old gas station turned into a restaurant. So, but to answer your original question, we do not, you know, our Tuesdays do not revolve around tacos. No.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. I'm curious. Maybe one day I'll hit up that.
Do yours?
No.
Do your Tuesdays involve tacos? My
Tuesdays used to involve tacos, and then I realized that I was eating too many tacos. So, so no, they don't revolve around Taco Tuesday. But for some reason, I have like a group of friends that think that I still do. So, like, occasionally on a Tuesday, I'll get a text that's like "Happy Taco Tuesday," and I'm like, they don't get it. I haven't informed them, but it's sweet.
So when someone says Tuesday for anything, you're like, you just consider it Taco Tuesday?
Yeah.
It's totally. Not actually Tuesday in your
calendar.
No,
it's not actually Tuesday. It's Taco Tuesday. Anyways, so we are at the final wrap of our accelerator/incubator 3-episode series within our season one related to accelerator programs. And I'm really excited because joining us this week is Rachel Shepherd. Rachel is a director of ventures at Mars Pet Care, where she manages the LEAP Accelerator programs and early stage pet care companies. Previously, she worked at the Founder Institute, where they provide entrepreneurs and teams with a support network and like structured process to get funding. Rachel's background and experience in the startup and accelerator space is invaluable to people and entrepreneurs, founders, folks that are looking to, build a product. And we are really excited for her to join us on Inclusive Collective today. Welcome, Rachel. So excited to have you here with us.
Hi, Nadia. Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I'm very excited to be here and truly honored that you invited me to be a part of this conversation today.
Well, we are excited to have you, Rachel. So welcome. Great to see you again. I think it would be helpful if we started with you helping us out and talking to us about your current program, LEAP Venture Studio, which is part of Mars. And I didn't realize that it was focused on founders that are female and or persons of color. I think it's such a cool way for Mars to have like a really positive impact. And so can you just talk about where the need for that program came from, and then why that's such a targeted approach was necessary to funding entrepreneurs and pet care, and what type of impact you all have had?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you said, I'm the director of ventures here at Mars Pet Care, which means I get to run the LEAP Ventures Studio program alongside our amazing partners. And what we do is we support seed and Series A stage pet care focused startups. And so we do that through our core product, which is our seed stage accelerator. That's 12 weeks. We, do everything from make strategic introductions to providing one-on-one support to also delivering on projects for each of the companies that are selected through each cohort. We select 6 per cohort. Those amazing projects are done by RJ Venture Studio. It's a real honor to get to help run this program. To date, we've had 5 cohorts complete, a total of 33 companies, and we've already had 2 exits, which is really exciting.
Nice.
Yeah. And the portfolio has raised $173 million in follow-on capital as well. So we've had some real success in the portfolio so far, and we've gotten a chance to invest in and work with some really amazing pet care startups and pet care founders. I joined the program and the company about 11 months ago, just shy of 11 months ago. And so when I joined, all of this was already in place. So I'm really sort of stepping in to continue the wonderful work of people who've come before me and people who have been setting up some amazing resources and structure for pet care focused startups. One of those programs that you mentioned, Rob, and you were asking about specifically is really our Leap Venture Academy, right, which is our bootcamp and fellowship programs that are focused on even earlier stage companies. That's like pre-seed to seed. So sometimes they don't quite have a product in the market yet, maybe not even some revenue, but they're an underrepresented founder and they're interested in continuing to grow within the pet care space. And they'd love to get connected with pet care thought leaders and, you know, Mars in general, and also, you know, get a chance to really iterate on their company a little bit. And so we run these sort of shorter term programs that are, you know, somewhere between 4 or 5 days and really kind of help founders overcome what are some of their biggest challenges in the early stages. That also gives us a chance to really get to know founders at the earlier stage and spend time completely dedicated to underrepresented founders. So those programs are only for underrepresented founders. And we do that so that we have an opportunity to get to know them, get to know their business, and honestly, understand more about their greater vision. Because when you make an investment in a company, you're investing in sure what they're doing right now, but you're really investing in the person and their greater vision. And so there really is no way to do that off of a pitch deck to totally understand someone's big vision and how they want to change the world and make a better world for pets. And so the best way for us to do that is actually spend some time, get to know a little bit more about them and a little bit more about what they're working on.
Very cool.
So, Rachel, that's great background. Thanks for sharing all of that. So you've worked with or been around a lot of startups and various accelerators and all those different ecosystems, and obviously from a global perspective as well. So what advice do you give participants on how they make the most of that experience as they're coming into an accelerator?
That's a great question. The first thing that I would say to any startup who's, you know, joining an accelerator program is to really delve into the network as much as possible. Network is something that still plays a very large role in the success of startups ultimately, right? So a lot of startups are able to get fundraising because they know someone who knows someone, you know, like, and so networks are really powerful and important. And so that's number one. I would say number two, be very clear and vocal about what you need and be very collaborative within that network. So, you know, I often ask founders, like, what is your biggest challenge? I genuinely want to know what the answer to that question is so that I can go and try to find something that can help them with that challenge. And so the clearer they are on it, the better I'm able to help them ultimately. And so I would say, you know, just getting very clear on what your challenges are, being very collaborative, you know, that ultimately leads to more warmer connections. And, you know, it's always great when you've been, you know, both the recipient of somebody who's helped you as well as you've been able to help them. And that just strengthens your networking and your relationships over time, which are super important. And then the third thing I would say is to be somewhat open. When you're building something from scratch, I have deep empathy for the fact that that is very emotionally tied to what you care about, right? Like you're every ounce of your time and efforts has been poured into this thing that is a company, but people are going to pick it apart, right? And that is going to happen. And some of that's going to be good advice. Some of it's not going to be good advice, but I think being able to pull yourself a little bit away from it just while you're getting this feedback from investors, from founders, from other people in the network, and be able to hear the feedback and make changes where you feel like, yes, that's aligned for me. I think that's the right way to go. Also being, you know, feel justified in saying that's not for me, but can find that some founders are so closed, I would say, to any feedback that it becomes very difficult to be able to accelerate them, right? Because that's part of the process is iteration.
Sure. So what are some of the challenges that these founders experience? Like, I'm curious if there's, you know, have you observed any sort of like bias in the work, or is it challenges related to getting capital, getting their product marketed? What are some of the types of things that you're observing?
Yeah, so I'll answer that in two parts. So I think the challenges I see a lot of people face, a lot of founders, are product market fit and fundraising. So product market fit is sort of inherently challenging, right? Because you've done all this customer development and you're like, people have told me that they want this solution. And then when you ask them to pay for it, they're like, maybe not, you know? And it's like this, you know, or, you know, there's some friction in the model, right? Like there's something's not working, it's not flowing just yet. And that is super difficult because it's hard to pinpoint exactly what's wrong. You know, it's hard to understand exactly why people aren't picking this up at the pace that you thought they would. you know, and when you go back deep enough into these really big success stories of startups, you find that they struggled with this too, always, mm-hmm. right? And there was some major pivot that kind of caused product market fit to happen. And then you started to see the market pull demand from the company as opposed to the company mm-hmm. just desperately trying to get out there in front of people. And so these pivot points are very elusive and sort of, you know, hard to really, I can't say, you know, do this and then it'll work, right? Like, you know, that's mm-hmm. not, that's unfortunately not how it works. And so that's something I've seen all founders sort of come into, you know, terms with at some point, right? It's just this product mm-hmm. market fit challenge. And also fundraising. Fundraising is hard, period. I think that it's just, it's mm-hmm. a very difficult thing to do. It's hard to get people to believe in what you're building. It's hard to ask for money. A lot of people aren't very comfortable with that inherently as humans, right? And so like, right. there's so many things about it that make it very difficult. Sometimes you get like a maybe, sometimes from investors as well. And I think that's even harder than hearing yes or no in some ways, or harder than hearing no, because you want to know why, right? And maybe right. doesn't really give you directional feedback. And so it's a hard space to navigate. And a lot of founders have challenges with that. This kind of gets into your question about bias, though, because fundraising, we know that there's a lot of bias in fundraising. And I was thinking about this quite a bit, and I want to kind of break bias down into three categories. So I think there's bias in action, which at least in that case, people can call you out on that. If people see you doing that, not you necessarily, but just anyone, they can call people out on that. There's bias of opinion, which I think we're at least in a world now where I think more people I'm speaking specifically to tech, are thinking mm-hmm. about how they might be biased, right? Like there's at least some, hopefully conversations like the last episode you guys Woo! Did, right?
Like, yeah.
Hopefully there's conversations happening around that. But at least if yeah. you're just as a person, because none of us are perfect mm-hmm. and all of us are sort of carrying our own unique experiences with us all the time and to the table. Are we asking ourselves enough questions to be aware of our own biases, right?
Sure.
And so I think that that's something that we're at least starting to see more people ask themselves some questions. Again, lots of work to do. And bias in action, tons of work to do there as well. All of these types of biases upset me. But the one that keeps me up at night is bias in a system, because systems are even more challenging, in my opinion, because they're no one person is responsible. So it's not like you can say this person needs to fix their behavior or their biases. It's kind of subtle biases across lots of different humans, you know, who also are working within the system. So it's like, it's kind of a little more complicated, and those types of things keep me up at night because no one person is responsible, A, and B, because it also can scale. So like a system can mm-hmm. scale and affect a lot of people. And if we aren't fixing those systems quickly enough, those types of things can do real damage and really cause a lot of issues in tech in general. And so to kind of loop all of this back to what are some challenges I've seen founders face, and how does systematic bias play into that role? Systematic bias, a great example of how this is playing out in our world today is angel investment. So angel investment is an opportunity for wealthy people to write checks to startup founders to ultimately, you know, create unicorns, right? And get them started with their early startup capital. Mm-hmm. And I think a huge part of investment, particularly at the early stage, and I would say this even accounts for pre-seed and seed investments, is you're investing in the founder. A lot of what we're going to see is going to pivot and change and, you know, ultimately continue to work towards product market fit and adapt to the markets as it scales. But what's really challenging is that when enough people are not investing in angel investment to create enough different experiences of life to be able to resonate with enough solutions, we are going to see people struggle to raise money in the pre-seed and seed stage. So an example of that would be like, you know, not having enough female angel investors may lead to fewer women's health solutions getting off the ground in the early stages, because we're not seeing enough investors empathize with the solution and or be able to connect with the founder on the problem that they're solving. And so like those types of things are things that I worry about, because angel investment, we've started to see some small improvements in the changes of what allows somebody to be accredited. Those standards are still very high in terms of whether or not somebody can be an accredited angel investor. You're looking at, you know, 200K as an individual income, I think, over the last 2 years, and then 300K as a couple, or $1 million in assets. There are a lot of people who could afford to write $1,000, $2,000 checks that may not be in those categories. And so, and they may meet someone and believe in what they're doing and they can't help them. And so we're starting to see now more vehicles around helping non-accredited investors participate in angel investments and things like that. And that's something that I feel very strongly needs to continue to happen in the future so that we can get more institutional investors who come from diverse backgrounds, et cetera, so that more founders get funded. And then the networks have exponential effects from there. And so I think that it's super important for more diversity to be in investment in general. And I think angel investment is just a, an example right now of how we can continue to work around what is ultimately a system that is keeping a lot of people out right now, to put pressure on the system so that it changes, so that ultimately we're able to see more people make angel investments in more companies that may represent more people and more solutions that are just currently being overlooked right now.
I love that. And I think that I really appreciate how thoughtful you are around the different types of biases and systemic bias. And so just want to keep going on that for a little bit more. So there's a lot of biases built in the system, right? So we know that women tend to be less comfortable making grandiose statements in their presentation, right? Like, in the, and you talked about that the founders in general don't like to go out and ask for money, but I would assume that the women are probably less comfortable in asking for large amounts of money. You talked about the dependence on the network and the fact that underrepresented founders don't have networks to tap into. They have, or they have less networks oftentimes. So is the model just itself, is there, are there, do you look at a lot of other different systemic biases in just the early stage funding process, and how do you think about mitigating those biases?
That's a great question. So one of the things that I think about a lot is, have I discovered biases in like pitching, everything? So every piece of this, yes, is an opportunity for bias. Pitching in person is an opportunity for bias to play a role. In introductions from there or another category where bias can play a role. And if you raise a seed round, let's say, if, for example, you have an early stage startup and you raise a seed round and you meet 100 investors, those 100 investors probably came from a total of 200 people. So let's say somebody introduced you to somebody, and, you know, so on and so forth. Let's just say that each one of those is an opportunity for bias if the networks are not diverse enough. So the interesting part about that is, if you are talking to 100 people to raise a seed round, that is a beautiful opportunity for diverse investment, right? Like, that is, that's you could talk to investors from every different spectrum and walk of life at that point. Not every, but, you know, lots of different spectrums and walks of life at that point. Or you could end up, you know, if the first 10 people you ask all look the same and all of their networks look the same and come from the same backgrounds, or you end up talking to the same person 100 times. And I feel like the system of networks is sort of inherently biased in and of itself. And I do think that the number one thing has to be, people have to put in the work to meet people outside of their industry, outside of their walk of life, outside of their region, outside of, you know, their identity, outside of as many different categories as you can imagine, so that you can learn from each other. And so that you can now have that in your mind, because so much about working in accelerators and VC in general is top of mind. Like, you have sort of a list of, you know, people, potential people to connect people with at the top of mind. And it's the more recently you've spoken with somebody, the easier that will be. And so if you are constantly sort of intentionally pushing yourself outside of your own networks to meet somebody new, you will have more people top of mind to connect people with. And I think that's a really important way to start to break down biases. I'm aware of the fact that everybody working in this industry is very busy. But I think at the end of the day, it could literally take 5 minutes. And every day, if you spent 5 minutes spending some time making a connection for somebody who may not have as strong of a network as you do, for whatever reason that brings, you know, that brings them to that part of their life, if they're ready to start a startup and you can open that door for them, you could take 5 minutes and open that door for them. And I've had people do it for me, and it has changed my life. It has brought me to this point where I am today, where I have this amazing job. And I wouldn't be there if people hadn't sort of unlocked doors for me and literally taken like 5 minutes to just put me top of mind for somebody else, or put my name in the ring, or introduce me to someone. So those things do matter, and they can be exponential.
And you tend to pay it back, or pay it forward, I should say, because you have absolutely introduced Rob and I to folks to help us navigate the startup and venture capital world through this podcast. So yeah, you role model that behavior. So that's so great.
Thank you. I try. I definitely, there's always more that can be done, but I try.
Yeah. So kind of on that note, I'm curious. So the systemic bias that you have mentioned, I know that the work you do is global, but it also started out global, right? So from that international perspective, I'm just curious, like, what are some of the biases that are they the same types of biases that you see on an international platform when you're working with startup founders, venture capitalists, and so on and so forth throughout the global context? Are the challenges and biases the same, or are they different? And if they're different, how are they different?
I love that question. I would say yes and no. And so I say yes, they're the same. And then I've seen, particularly across the work I've done with female founders around the world, a lot of the same challenges being faced, you know, across countries, right? And so I do think female founders are often experiencing some of the same challenges, you know, especially, you know, when they're in those early stages of still trying to prove that their idea is valid and that their company is possible, their bigger vision's possible, and that somebody should take a bet on them, so to speak, right? And fund them. Right. I see a lot of that. And then I would say there are differences, there are nuances. So I would say, yes, there are challenges where everybody's facing underrepresentation, or the underrepresented founders are everywhere around the world. Mm-hmm. That may change and be more nuanced depending on where in the world we're talking about. But I think that's something that I have seen in most countries to a certain extent.
Right. And I would imagine the dimension of diversity that you're speaking to, right? So like whether it's a racial diversity aspect, or whether it's, you know, folks from the LGBTQ or neurodivergence or disability community. So I would imagine they're all similar and different all at the same time.
Yes. And I think the part for me that's super important in helping us all work towards a better future for everyone, right? Like, because getting back to, you know, there's always more work to be done, right? And there's always more reflection to be done. There's always more of our own biases we can put in check, and so on and so forth. I think so much about that is just listening. It's just going to other countries, sitting down with people who are in the startup ecosystem and saying, what is your biggest challenge, right? And starting to ask these questions that unfold a lot of different nuance of what they're facing as founders. Of course, even if we can't travel to the place, just in connecting with people outside of your own network, outside of your geography, and saying, you know, what do things look like for you? I think that was one of the most powerful things about being able to work with people in over 90 countries is Silicon Valley is a bubble. I live here, right? Like it's changed a bit since, you know, COVID and the pandemic, but, you know, I think it's one of those things where understanding about the nuance of startup ecosystems all over the world and how culture plays into how startup ecosystems are built, or how governments play into how startup ecosystems are built, you know, infrastructure, proximity to capital, access to capital, all these things play these roles into how much opportunity a startup in any given region has. And so I think that getting a chance to learn from people firsthand and just listen to what they had to say was incredibly powerful. And it has continued to be very helpful. And I'm still learning. You know, I last week alone, I went and I learned about a whole new pet care ecosystem, right? Like there's these opportunities to do that. And I think learning is a huge piece of what is going to help us all sort of create a better world for everybody and ultimately create more opportunities for startups in the future.
Sure.
Rachel, I want to stay on your perspective on female founders, given all the work that you've done over the years, right? So I was thinking about my own parental role and how difficult it is just to get shit done on a day-to-day basis, right? So to be a good, attentive, loving parent. and run a business. And I'm aware that most often women, that those duties fall to women. They tend to bear more responsibilities at home. So just talk about how that impacts the ability of a woman to start a company and what advice that you give to mothers that are potentially starting new ventures.
That's a great question. To be totally honest, I'm not a mom, so I'm not giving any advice to mothers out there. They're doing an amazing job. They're super brave and strong and awesome. And yep. When they're also starting companies, I applaud them for so many reasons. But I would say, kind of on this topic of caregivers and how do they mm-hmm. create time and opportunity to start companies as well, and how does that not end up working against them? I've actually seen and identified that I find that people who have less time actually hyper-focus much faster. And so I find that it can actually be a really great advantage, right? Like, so if you don't have a lot of time, you have, you know, you're like, I'd love to work 100 hours, but I have 40. So here's what I can do with my 40 hours. You're probably more likely to tell me exactly what challenges you have facing, exactly what you need. And that's how I can help you grow your company faster. And so I do think there's some really inherent benefits to being somebody who has to balance, you know, multiple sides of life. I think the challenges come with some things that are inherent to startups in general. We've seen some of that go on pause for the pandemic, and I'm wondering how we'll end up on the other side of that. So, for example, a lot of happy hours. We host happy hours. A lot of people host happy hours. Happy hours are not necessarily inclusive. Not only to people who have caregiving responsibilities after work, but also to people who don't drink or people who would prefer not to be in bars at night. Women, for example. You know what I mean? Like there's all types of reasons why happy hours are not as inclusive. And so, you know, we'll intentionally take coffee meetings with our places with people as well and try to make things not as centralized around what a traditional startup ecosystem looks like, right? So that's one example. The other is travel, which I think we have yet to determine how much that will be a part of actually fundraising in the future. Because I do think there's some real benefits to being able to spend time with somebody and you know, learn about them and their company and their business and their team. But I do think that if you have caregiving responsibilities, it's a lot harder to travel. And so, I'm assuming. It's a lot harder to travel. And so
it is. Yeah, it is.
And so, and you know, that shouldn't make it harder for somebody to fundraise. So I think the pandemic has brought us a lot of solutions that said, hey, we can do this no matter what, you know, meaning we can fundraise and you can pitch to us no matter what. And it can be virtual or in person. It doesn't really matter. But I do think that we have yet to totally figure out if that's what people really want. And by that, I mean, is that what investors really want, is to have be pitched virtually long-term? So I think that's kind of up in the air. Or, you know, will investors be encouraged to travel more to founders, which is also an option too. It doesn't have to always be the other way around. So that's something we'll have to start, you know, figuring out. But along those lines, I think that there is nothing that should stop somebody from being able to start their company. If they want to start their company and they have a good company, none of the rest of the stuff should matter, right? Like, you know, it should just be like, I think that this person can do this. And whether or not they're a caregiver should not play a role in whether or not somebody can do something. I think if you are a caregiver, you're probably more likely to get it done. But that's just my own opinion sort of playing in as well. And maybe my own bias, but that is how I see things.
That's great.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, Rachel, thank you so much. We're so excited that you joined us today. Where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
That's a great question. They can find me at leapventurestudio.com. That's probably the best place to look for more information. That is the best place to look for more information about our pet care focused accelerator. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me on there. That's the only social platform I like to participate in actively. So I'm on there and you can find me on there and message me and, connect with me. If you have a question, I'm always happy to answer and always happy to take a call.
Well, Rachel Shepard, it's been a pleasure having you. Thank you for joining today on Inclusive Collective.
Thank you, Nadia. Thank you, Rob. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Welcome back from our conversation with Rachel Shepard. Time for Calm Reflections. And so, Nadia, what I really enjoyed, so I love talking to Rachel. I thought she was really thoughtful, obviously just very insightful about accelerators and gave a lot of great advice for founders. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated that it seems like they've done the work there in terms of really trying to think about bias in their own processes and in the procedures and just their entire model. And obviously, certainly with the programs that they have there, but also just really thinking about the impact of the decisions in terms of how they're going to allocate funds and who they're going to bring into that program. And so I just thought that everything's very purposeful and they're very mindful of their own biases. And I think that it was really great to hear.
Yeah, totally. You know, Rachel's advice was like spot on. She said like networking's important. We've been hearing that throughout from various people, right? Being very clear about what you think or what you stand for from a product perspective. And then this kind of final piece of being receptive to feedback, I thought really cool elements. But what I really, really loved, which she kind of threw down, was this breakdown in the three biases that she observed in the fundraising world specifically, right? So she said the first one was bias in action. The second was bias of opinion. And then the third, which she said she like, which, you know, where she said she loses sleep on, was this bias in a system. And she mentions that no one person is responsible for the bias in the system, right? It's a subtle bias across many people that are working within a system. And so that can scale and affect people in damaging ways. So I want to talk about bias.
Okay.
And particularly because of the bias that shows up in the business world, most of it is it's not ill-intentioned, right? Like most people aren't walking around being like, I want to be an asshole today, right? Like, I mean, some people might be, but I think for the most part, people want to treat people kindly and fairly.
Right.
So what do I mean by biases? What are biases? There are these seminal scholars that talk about these seminal scholars named Banji and Greenwalk who researched this work, and they argue that much of our social behaviors are driven by learned stereotypes that operate automatically and therefore unconsciously. So what we're talking about today is this type of blind spot, right? These terms are being used, unconscious or implicit bias, right? So now, according to Psychology Today, the average human has How many thoughts per day does the average human have?
The average, how many thoughts per day? 7,000.
17,000 to 50,000 thoughts per day. According to Psychology Today, there's variances amongst this. But I was trying to take it from like empirical research.
Sure.
So some of these thoughts are social stereotypes, right? About certain groups of people that we've essentially formed throughout our life based on like who we interact with, how we view the world, kind of how we grew up. And because of how much information and thoughts are thrown at us on a daily basis, our brains tend to categorize kind of these points of data or this information, and we compartmentalize them, right? But what happens then is we generalize and we make assumptions based off of that and stereotypes off of that. And to really help us make more sense or sort through all of that information and data. So that's how our brains are working. This leads to the kind of misrepresentations or assumptions about people that we have because we've categorized them into these groups. So one thing that's really important is that to know that we all have biases, right? Most times they're hidden, right? And bias typically shows up in your decision-making and in your interactions. And they're even more apparent in high-stress situations or navigating in times of crisis. Bias doesn't have to be a negative word, though. And that's one thing that I think is really important to kind of just, as we peel back that onion, in a TechCrunch article that was written in 2015 that I think is still relevant today, it was an article called Surprising Bias of Venture Capital Decision Making. They talk about how on the surface, it appears that investors have everything under control, right? Like they're exerting confidence in their decisions as they hit, like, you know, consistent home runs kind of in the world of funding and getting investments. But as we peel back those layers, empirical research shows that they are extremely challenging and costly cognitive biases that show up.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob, you and I do a lot of work around process thinking to mitigate bias. And so you know, like we could spend all day talking about this and how it shows up and et cetera, but some biases that show up in the investor's pitch kind of process or the demo day, and I think I'm speaking specifically of an investor bias and how to uncover some of that. One is through affinity bias, right? So where we make decisions based on how we connect with someone on like a more personal interpersonal level.
Sure.
So maybe we went to the same college as the founder or grew up in some city, the same city as the founder. So as the investor, your likability subtly starts to favor the founder because of these things. Another bias that's mentioned in the TechCrunch article is information overload bias.
Hmm.
And that, isn't that interesting? So this is where investors typically have to process large amounts of data. For example, when they're analyzing technologies or teams or markets or trends, maybe business models and different types of risks in the investor pitch or demo day, the massive amount of information provided to investors can result in information overload. And the reality is that more information does not necessarily equate to better decision, right? So bias could absolutely show up there and not in a favorable way. So now your question is like, well, what do we do about it?
Right.
I mean, I know you know what to do, but what can we share to our listeners? The first thing is maybe take the implicit association test that's available through Harvard. That kind of helps you measure like your attitudes or your beliefs that people may have unwillingly or unable to report on like their likability or perceptions on a group of people. I would say, and many of our guests have said this, like learn from people outside of your own identities. But the first step in doing that is recognizing your own identities first, right? So it's understanding, you know, who you are in your own privilege. The third is listen and reflect. A deep reflection is so critical.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, it's calling Rob and I for coaching, training, and consulting. Just a little plug there.
Yeah, you're full. Yeah. You're lots of plugs. Yeah. From Nadia.
Yeah. So a lot that I said.
Yeah. I really like that. I'm really glad you took us through all of that. And I think that I really like the part where, you know, just the starting point is that bias is not necessarily a bad thing, right? So get comfortable with your bias, right? So like that is such an important step in actually making change and being able to create an inclusive culture is getting people on the same page about understanding what biases they have so that you can interrupt it in some way, right? Either at a personal level or at a systemic level, right? And so,
right.
You know, so I think that's, I'm glad you focused on that. It's not a bad thing. It's really important in order to be able to make change in an organization.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for that, Nadia. That's going to be it for this week's episode. So the Inclusive Collective podcast is a production of Refilion Media. If you like what you hear, please be sure to like, rate, subscribe, wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear your feedback at www.refilion.com. And you can find us on Instagram at Inclusive Collective Podcast. I'm your co-host, Rob Hadley.
And I'm Nadia Butt.
See you next week.